second decision-making during a crisis. It would give the president time to think, permit the United States to apply force incrementally, and reduce the threat of all-out nuclear war. Burke argued that a strategy of massive retaliation no longer made sense. Nobody wins a suicide pact. A decade earlier, the Navy had criticized the Air Force for targeting Soviet cities, calling the policy ruthless and barbaric. Now the Navy claimed that was the only sane and ethical way to ensure world peace. As the debate over nuclear strategy grew more heated within the Eisenhower administration and in the press, General Curtis LeMay showed absolutely no interest in limited war, graduated deterrence, finite deterrence, or anything short of total victory. The United States should never enter a war, LeMay felt, unless it intended to win. And a counterforce policy that targeted the Soviet Union's nuclear assets was far more likely to prevent a war than a strategy that threatened its cities. Unlike the public mind that feared a nuclear holocaust, he argued, the professional military mind in both nations worried more about preserving the ability to fight, about losing airfields, missile bases, command centers. Sack claimed that a counterforce strategy was also the most humane method of waging war, since there was no necessity to bomb cities. But that argument was somewhat disingenuous. In order to hit military targets, LeMay acknowledged, weapons must be delivered with either very high accuracy or very high yield or both. Because the accuracy of a bomb was less predictable than its yield, he favored the use of powerful weapons. They could miss a target and still destroy it, or destroy multiple targets at once. They would also, unavoidably, kill millions of civilians. LeMay wanted SAC to deploy a hydrogen bomb with a yield of 60 megatons, a bomb more than 4,000 times more powerful than the one that destroyed Hiroshima. By the late 1950s, the absence of a clear targeting policy and the size of America's stockpile had created serious command and control problems. The Army, the Navy, and the Air Force all planned to attack the Soviet Union with nuclear weapons, but had done little to coordinate their efforts. Until 1957, the Strategic Air Command refused to share its target list with the other armed services. When the services finally met to compare war plans, hundreds of time-over-target conflicts were discovered. Cases in which, for example, the Air Force and the Navy unwittingly planned to bomb the same target at the same time. These conflicts promised to cause unnecessary overkill and threaten the lives of American air crews. The Joint Chiefs of Staff soon recognized that the chaos of war would be bad enough without competing nuclear war plans to make it worse. They decided that the United States had to develop atomic coordination machinery, an administrative system to control what targets would be attacked, who would attack them, which weapons would be used, and how those attacks would be timed. The decision prompted the Army, Navy, and Air Force to battle even more fiercely over who would control that system. The Air Force wanted a single atomic war plan run by a centralized command. SAC would head that command and take over the Navy's Polaris submarines. The Navy was outraged by that idea and joined the other services in offering a counterproposal. The Navy, the Air Force, and NATO should retain separate war plans, but coordinate them more efficiently. The issues at stake were fundamental, and basic questions needed to be addressed. Should the command structure be centralized or decentralized? Should the attack be all-out or incremental? Should the strategy be counterforce or city-busting? The President of the United States, once again, had to decide the best way not only to fight the Soviet Union, but also to settle a dispute over nuclear weapons at the Pentagon. During a meeting at the White House in 1956, President Eisenhower had listened patiently to General Taylor's arguments on behalf of a flexible response. Eisenhower wasn't persuaded that a war could be won without hydrogen bombs. He was fatuous to think that the U.S. and the USSR would be locked into a life-and-death struggle, he told Taylor, without using such weapons. Eisenhower thought both sides would use them at once. 4 years later, his views remained largely unchanged. If NATO forces were attacked, he said during another White House discussion of limited war, an all-out strike on the Soviet Union would be the only practical choice. Pausing to negotiate a diplomatic settlement seemed unrealistic. That sort of thing happened only in novels like Red Alert. Confronted with the choice between destroying Soviet military targets or cities, Eisenhower decided that the United States should destroy both. The new targeting philosophy combined elements of Air Force and Navy doctrine. It was called the optimum mix. In August 1960, General Nathan Twining, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, resolved the dispute over how a nuclear war would be planned and controlled. A joint strategic target planning staff would be formed. Most of the officers would be drawn from the Air Force, although the other services would be represented. The targeting staff would be based at SAC headquarters in Omaha and led by SAC's commander. The Navy could keep its Polaris submarines, but the aiming points of their missiles would be chosen in Omaha. Twining ordered that a single integrated operational plan, PSYOP, be completed by the end of the year. The PSYOP would serve as America's nuclear war plan. The PSYOP would spell out precisely when, how, and by whom every enemy target would be struck. And the PSYOP would be inflexible. Twining had instructed that atomic operations must be pre-planned for automatic execution to the maximum extent possible. The Navy was furious about the new arrangement. Admiral Burke thought it represented a power grab by the Air Force and later accused the Strategic Air Command of using exactly the same techniques, the methods of control favored by the communists. And he warned that once the PSYOP was adopted, it would be hard to change. The systems will be laid, Burke told William B. Frank, the Secretary of the Navy. The grooves will be dug, and the power will be there because the money will be there. The electronic industry and all of those things. We will wreck this country if we are not careful. President Eisenhower was unfazed by Burke's critique of the PSYOP, its underlying strategy, and its command and control machinery. This whole thing has to be on a completely integrated basis, Eisenhower said. The initial strike must be simultaneous. The strategic planning